Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
It's very difficult to keep the line between the past and the present.
You believe that someone out of the past can enter and take possession of a living being?
We may be through with the past, but the past is not through with us.
Welcome back to The Next Picture Show, a Movie of the Week podcast devoted to a classic film and the way it shaped our thoughts on a recent release. I'm Tasha Robinson, here again with
Keith Phipps,
Genevieve Kosky,
and Scott Tobias.
On last week's show, we talked about John Borman's 1981 fantasy film Excalibur, the epic story of King Arthur's life from preconception to his disappearance into the mist of legend. There are a lot of similar mists in The Green Knight, David Lowery's low-key fantasy film, which takes place on the edges of King Arthur's legend. Or at least we assume it's King Arthur, since he, Guinevere, Merlin, Morgana, and others are never named, and only identified in the credits with names like King, Queen, and Mother. The director of previous Next Picture Show pairing choices, Pete's Dragon, A Ghost Story, and The Old Man and the Gun, takes an alternately minimalist and maximalist approach to one Arthurian legend, as a supernatural creature rides into Arthur's court on Christmas Day and challenges any knight to deal him a blow, which he'll return in kind in 1 year. Arthur's nephew, Gawain, played by Dev Patel, and with his name pronounced at least three different ways in the movie, isn't yet a knight. He has no mighty deeds to his name, and frankly, he's kind of a cowardly wastrel. But the king has just taken an interest in him for the first time, so Gawain is feeling the urge to prove himself, and he jumps up and chops off the Green Knight's head. People who know the medieval poem Lowry drew from for the story won't be surprised at what immediately follows, but the rest of the story wanders into increasingly strange territory, culminating in an ending that strongly evokes another familiar film more than it evokes the legend that many of us already know. We'll talk about the influences and the shocking, thrilling look and feel and intent of The Green Knight up next, after this.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Friends, brothers and sisters, who can regale me and my queen with some myth? Or tale?
Night. This may be one of those, if you don't like this film, I don't know that I want to talk to you kind of films, but let's hear what people thought.
Wow, that's a real discussion opener.
This seems aimed at me.
I am perfectly willing to put a chilling effect on people in this room. On the other hand, if Scott was concerned about like losing my respect because he disagrees with me, I think I think that ship sailed 1,000 years ago. It's just not something he worries about. I can't picture.
I'm not sure if that, whether it means I've completely lost it or I have it despite disagreeing with you on a lot of stuff.
Well, we're about to find out. Scott, what did you think of The Green Knight?
Yeah, I really liked it a lot. I'm gonna need everybody to help me, you know, interpret it, because it was way too abstract for me, and I didn't really, I wasn't familiar enough with the source material. I felt like I just didn't do my homework for this thing. I just experienced it, which was fine. It reminded me a little bit of what it felt like watching the Nick Reffin Viking movie Valhalla Rising, where it's clear, the mission itself is very basic. But it just grows increasingly, you know, abstract, you know, as it goes along. As you said in the introduction, both minimalist and maximalist. But there's no arguing with the style of the film and the ambition of it. And I was just utterly mesmerized by it. It's absolutely beautiful to look at and kind of one of a kind. I thought it was excellent.
You're going to hear no argument from me here, but what this film did make me think about is just, it kind of highlighted for me some of maybe the bad movie watching habits I've grown into during quarantine and time away from theaters, because I did see this in the theater. Obviously, I actually saw it in at the Music Box in Chicago during a recent visit, which was very exciting. But, you know, this is a film that I think if you have even a passing knowledge of either this poem or just Arthurian legend in general, you're gonna kind of like feel that itch in your brain to solve what's happening, to like figure out the puzzle of this film. And there were just so many times where I like just felt the urge to like whip out my phone and Google something to am I getting this? Am I understanding this correctly? You know, also I have become heavily reliant on subtitles in my time away from theaters. My hearing is not awesome and getting less awesome by the day. So there was definitely, in Music Box, for as much as I love it, does not have a particularly robust sound system. So, you know, I was definitely struggling to kind of understand the, you know, what was happening in this film, and at the same time struggling against my impulse to figure out what was happening, and at the expense of just experiencing the film, which I think is absolutely what you should be doing with this film. Like, I'm not arguing that I wanted to be, I did want to be able to look up stuff, but I shouldn't have been able to, you know, like that's not how I think this film is meant to be watched. But I think it definitely, because it is playing so fast and loose with the idea of myth and legend and history, and, you know, doing some very character-based storytelling as opposed to like adaptation-based, I guess, storytelling, there is a temptation to solve it. And especially that ending, which I know we will get to, you know, there's already just a flurry of ending explainers and explainers in general on this movie, which I absolutely get. You know, I'm in the biz. It's a movie that people are going to want to read about. But it's also just such a David Lowery film that I think to think of it in that way is really limiting. So I'm grateful that I got to watch it this way, even if it was maybe a little hard.
I haven't weighed in yet. I'm going to say I liked it too. I liked it a lot. I liked this. I was pretty enthralled by this film from beginning to end. I think the soundtrack was a little, you know, you might want to have your hearing checked anyway, but I think the soundtrack is a little mushy in this movie. At least I experienced that as well. And I saw it in a different theater. You're right. I don't think this film wants to be solved necessarily. So we can just kind of end the podcast here and just call it a night. I think it's a lyrical film, both in the way that term is usually used, but also in kind of being lost in language that doesn't necessarily want to be read literally, you know, the cinematic equivalent of that. I thought that was kind of a wondrous thing to watch. I like this film quite a bit.
Yeah, honestly, I felt pretty safe saying that at the top of the show, because it just seems like such our jam collectively. You know, it's a visually rich and gorgeous film that gives you a lot to think about while it's going on and a lot to talk about afterwards. It doesn't seem deliberately obscure or like obscurantist. Basically, it doesn't feel like aggressively mysterious, and it certainly doesn't feel like no thought was put into it. I think that that sensation of I don't know what's going on here in a film can sometimes be frustrating when you don't get the feeling that a lot of thought has been put into it. If somebody's just kind of throwing images at the screen, or if somebody comes from just such a different way of thinking from you that you know that you're not going to be able to understand it. I'm looking at you, Holy Motors, you know, that kind of movie where it just, it's coming from a completely different world. And it can be wonderful to look into that world, but you shouldn't think of those movies in terms of, well, I'm going to do the math to solve this puzzle and get to the solution at the end. That said, I didn't feel all that like thematically or symbolically lost here. I thought this movie operated very much on a kind of a familiar fantasy fairy tale logic for the most part. And while I'd be fascinated to hear David Lowery talk in detail about some of the decisions he's made and like how he reached them and what he wanted people to take from them, I didn't find myself wondering what's going on here most of the time. There's one big decision that I find a little baffling from a mythic perspective, from a legend perspective, from a symbolic perspective. There are a few things in this movie that I just want to ask him, okay, this though, but why? But I think that feeling of like your brain being fully engaged is something we maybe all look for at least somewhat in a movie. So yeah, when I say if you don't like this movie, I might not like you. It's not one of those, well, I could never date a person that doesn't like X movie. It's just more a like, do I understand you anymore kind of thing? Because this movie just seems so much us.
Yeah, I'd almost say that it's not the brain so much as the senses that are being engaged in this. You know, like that was what was so, so pleasurable about it is just he's just going somewhere. You know, he's going on a quest to reach this place. That is his. That is all he is doing in the film. And the rest of it, you can it gets filled in the way it gets filled in, and you can kind of just, you know, kind of lose yourself in the movie and not try to solve it at every moment, which I would have been futile for me anyway. What I did find myself doing, you know, not just for the podcast, I would have done this anyway, is just trying to just dive into what people are writing about it, just so I kind of could figure out what it is that I'd just seen. But I can tell you from watching it, it was just something that I felt my way through. And that's such a rare thing. You know, it's rare to have that experience at all. And it's rare to have it with a movie that's done with a certain amount of at a certain scale, at a certain, you know, because I think when movies get too big, they can't do that. They have to be much more literal minded. So it was nice to kind of, I guess maybe that's the A24 thing. Kind of, it's like well-produced sensual experiences.
And I think Dev Patel's central performance is really kind of key to that feeling, because he's so magnetic and so frankly sexy in this film, but also just so like viscerally like overwhelmed and just in over his head. And he's not like our guide through this, you know, we're kind of like fumbling through it alongside him, and we want to be there with him because he is just, like I said, magnetic. But, you know, just as a protagonist, he's kind of adrift, and I think we are purposely kind of adrift with him and figuring out what the hell is going on here.
Yeah, I like our friend Alicia Wilkinson at Vox has an explanatory piece on this, and I like her reading of the title as possibly referring to his inexperience.
I love that. Yeah,
that's a great read.
Yeah,
because it is very much about, you know, the coming, you know, falling into experience of someone who is, you know, has a lot of expectations, has a lot of, you know, who is kind of someone with imposter syndrome in a way. You know, he performs this valiant deed that everyone talks about that really isn't all that valiant. There's not a lot of necessarily even that much bravery or effort putting in cutting off the Green Knight's head. And now he has to figure out a way to live up to that and to live up to the ideals he's supposed to embody. And I think that is such an interesting story to follow through. And even if there's a lot of driftiness around Gawain throughout this, I think that aspect of his development and progress is very much an anchor for everything else.
Yeah, A.O. Scott referred to him in his review as a fail son, which is absolutely true. I mean, this is something that any one of the characters on Succession would do and then live to regret it. You know, they would being impulsive but not wise, you know, in trying to achieve something quickly is, you know, that's definitely fail son behavior. But it is, you know, he certainly ends up following through on what he's done. And the character does gain in depth as he accumulates experience and makes, you know, choices along the way. And it's a really dynamic character. And it's just, again, once you're having someone like Dev Patel, who's so charismatic, at the center of this movie, it really binds together a lot of the things that might be off-putting or too mysterious or enigmatic about it. It works because we have this very simple story and this very charismatic lead. I mean, that's we can attach ourselves to that and kind of like, you know, go on the ride that way.
I like the description, fail son, but also I interviewed Ralph Ineson, who starred in The Witch as the father, William, and has been in everything. He's just one of those kind of ubiquitous character actors. And he played the Green Knight here. He referred to Gawain as a feckless dickhead, which is just a description I like very much. I mean, he goes on to talk about how, you know, the wonder of Dev Patel's performance is making this feckless dickhead into a lovable character. And he says it's, you know, it's one of the most magnificent performances he's ever seen up close, because you can't kind of help but love Gawain even as you hate him. And I think that that's an interesting journey that he takes. I mean, we open with him in a brothel where he has been spending time with a lady, and it's just very clear from the start.
Well, not a lady. A woman, but she's not a lady as we discuss them in these terms.
She's not a capital L lady.
Right.
Well, she's played by Alicia Vikander, who will return later in the movie as an actual lady in a piece of double casting that seems very pointed in terms of his relationship with women and what women are in the era and the kind of the dichotomy between, you know, the low-born woman and the high-born woman. Because the low-born woman in this story is somebody noble who reaches out to him and tries to draw a beautiful picture of their future together, and he shrugs it off and ignores it. Whereas the lady, the highborn lady, played by the same actress, invites him to sully himself, which he takes her up on. You know, it's there's a lot of symbolism in what those two women want from him, what they do to him, what he takes from them, and the fact that it is actually the same woman. But leaving that aside, it's clear that he's neglected his mother. He's neglected his duties at church. He's neglected his duties at court in order to spend time with a harlot, a prostitute, a woman of the streets who cares very much for him. And he doesn't seem to have the same affection for her. And then he goes off to court and the king says, like, I've never spent time with you. You're my sister's son. And I should have. Come sit by me and tell me of your great deeds. And he's like, I ain't never done nothing. He has no past. He has no glorious deeds to do. He's kind of a loser. He's not a knight yet. And he says he's got all the time in the world to become a knight. But he's pretty old to not have done anything with his life in this society. And that's just kind of the setup of the story. And as he goes and experiences all of these things, I think we just see over and over and over that as a man, he's never built the tools to deal with any of the weird and wondrous stuff he encounters. He doesn't know what to do with it. And like, maybe he gains in knowledge and gains in bravery by the end of the story, but I'm not sure that he does it, you know, via any deeply inborn sense of honor or chivalry or any kind of charm or any kind of smarts. He just kind of falls from situation to situation.
Well, because all of that is bestowed on someone through legend, you know, and David Lowery is a filmmaker who has evinced a certain obsession with the idea of legend and myth and storytelling in his work. So I think like that is very much sort of his thematic focus here, and it comes across in a character who is not legendary sort of in the individual personal literal sense, but you know becomes legend through some sort of a noble force through which these things happen.
Well, we've done this before. I want to hear what baffled you, like what you couldn't decode, and I'll see if I can explain it for you, and I'll tell you what baffled me and what I couldn't decode and see if you can explain it for me.
One of my favorite parts of the movie, and the part that I do not see how it fits into the grand scheme of things, is the hallucinatory giants, the giant naked giants. He takes some sort of, he eats a mushroom or something before that, right? So in a sense, this is a sort of psychedelic experience he's having, but how it fits into the rest of the film, I'm not sure. There's kind of a nature spirit thing to them, which connects with a lot of other things in the film, but also, what the hell?
I actually do think that that's one of the, maybe the clearer symbols in the movie for me. I think that it ties into, like, I'm going to get a little bit ahead here with connections to Excalibur, but it's the magic going out of the world. Mm. You know, the giants are drifting off towards the horizon and disappearing into the mist. We start in an age of Camelot where all of the Knights of the Round Table look very old and very tired, and none of them step up to meet the Green Knight's challenge. Arthur and Guinevere look very old and very tired. Lancelot is gone. He's the one that's supposed to be by Arthur's side. This clearly is on the far side of the fall of Camelot. And I think that the giants leaving the world is just another symbol for the same thing that happens in Excalibur with Merlin and Morgana leaving the world. I think we're literally just saying we were in an age of legend, and that those legends are passing on, visibly passing on. And as we get to the end of the movie, we see a version of that happening, like, very, very literally. But I think this is the version of it happening symbolically.
So I think maybe my main point of confusion is Joel Edgerton's character, Lord character. We talked about sort of Alicia Vikander's dual role and the lady she plays, who is presumably married to Joel Edgerton's Lord. And specifically, and this is informed by my sort of like very superficial knowledge of the poem on which this is ostensibly based, or at least at the very least taking its title. And I know there is sort of a story of like a trading of gifts between the Lord and Gawain, and like what each, you know, claims that day they will give to the other one. And there's a kiss given from the lady that Gawain gives to the Lord. But that's like not how it plays out here. I'm going to let Tasha give me a precise and perfect explanation of what that means. But in the context of like watching the film, I think that was like a really clear example of where my outside knowledge of the subject matter muddied what was happening in the film, and kind of, again, contributing to that feeling of wanting to solve what was happening. So Tasha, please solve what was happening.
I don't know that I can solve that one per se. I mean, I was aware of the other legends specifically. Like, that's a very common fairy tale theme, is the, like, the bad bargain, or the bargain that you shouldn't have agreed to, that generally involves, you know, you're going to get something and you're going to trade it to me for something, and people agree. And then it turns out, you know, you're going to give me the first thing you see when you get back to your castle. And the he expects that he's going to see his dog when he gets back to the castle, because the dog always runs out and greets him. And instead, it's his son. You know, that kind of thing happens a lot in fairy tales. And here, the fact that this offer is made to him by somebody who always seems to have an agenda, it felt to me like this was a game that this lord and his wife played. You know, it doesn't seem like something done with like the forethought of magic or the forethought of legend. You know, this will result in you like giving me a child. It seems like something the two of them schemed up together, and that this is what they do for fun. And for a movie that's so concerned with sex, and specifically with like righteous sex and selfish sex, wrong sex, it seems to me that the temptation that the two of them offer separately, that in one case at least is dishonorable, and he sullies himself, like literally getting semen all over his mother's belt that came back to him in a very weird way. I feel like Joel Edgerton's offer is meant to be the righteous choice, because it's an honorable agreement that he made, and it's a fairly simple agreement to honor, and he still recoils from it. You know, he makes the wrong choice over and over. There's a certain like fecundity to that particular offer, given that it kind of comes like give me a kiss in exchange for this huge pile of dead animals that I hunted for you. Mm-hmm. And like, even so, he's reluctant and he runs away. Honestly, a little of that I just kind of took as like an exploration of internalized homophobia. Like, he's so terrified of this man, like giving him a kiss, offering him passion. What muddies that one for me is arguably the other thing that he got in the castle was the belt that his mother gave him back. And now it's stained with his own semen, which is a mark of what he did wrong, you know, a mark of the infidelity of this lord's lady, the mark of Gawain's weakness and shame. And he doesn't want to give it up because it's his protection, and he doesn't want to reveal it because he's dishonored himself with it. So, of course, he's going to recoil from the lord. Like, the lord offers him a bargain that was honorably struck, and there's no way for him to follow through on it without shaming himself. So of course he looks revolted and runs away. That was my read on it, at least.
That tracks. I also really like Joel Edgerton in this.
Oh God, he's so good.
I really just underrated, or maybe not underrated, but like, I feel like we don't talk enough about Joel Edgerton.
Underused, because I think every time he comes up, people are like, Joel Edgerton is so good, why don't we see more of him?
It's very good in the Underground Railroad.
Yes, loving too, right?
Nice guy.
And also in a film from 2004 called King Arthur, in which he played Gawain.
Oh, wow.
Not a very good film, though.
That's one of those fun coincidences. Let me tell you what baffled me, and see if anybody's got an answer for it. For me, the big question mark of the film is, so much of this stuff seems symbolic to me, seems fairy tale logic, as I've said. So Gawain is captured by bandits, and they take the Green Knight's
child
axe.
Bandits who overpower him, which is a delightful touch.
That is true. The child bandits overpower him, and among other things, they take his mother's belt, you know, which is meant to protect him from all harm. They take the Green Knight's axe, which the Green Knight left to him, which he's supposed to bring back to the Green Knight as like a symbol of his honor in fulfilling this bargain. And it seems that his quest is done because, you know, he's lost the signifiers of it. And then those things come back in his life casually. The belt maybe a little less casually, since the lady presents it to him as a temptation. But the axe is just kind of sitting there in the castle. And we never find out how the lord and lady came by it. And nothing's ever said about it. Like he doesn't even say, oh, thank goodness, now I can continue my quest. Or, oh no, now I have to continue my quest. It's just kind of there. And I guess maybe there's a fairy tale logic to, like, no, you can't just cry off because of some kid bandits. I would think that the lord found them on his land and killed them for being bandits, and that's how he came by those things. Except that we actually see their boy bandit leader who had the axe, like, later in the film, still running around. So those things coming back into the story in such a casual and offhanded and odd way just struck me as a very strange choice that I'm not sure what to make of.
Well, point of order, didn't the axe come back to him when he got St. Winifred's head? Mm-hmm. Isn't that when he got the axe? It wasn't at the Lord and Lady's castle?
That's correct.
Yeah.
Is that true? I definitely missed that. How does it happen?
I think it's like when he like awakes the next morning or something. It's like just sitting there in the cottage or wherever, whatever, like where like she's gone and the axe is there. So because of that, I just associate like this returning of his items to be associated with, you know, chivalric acts that he successfully completed. The belt coming back to him, or I'm sorry, the girdle coming back to him, like, I guess if you like want to read like a chivalric action into that, it's that he did not complete the act, or he didn't have intercourse with this woman. You know, he kept it outside if you want it. But basically he resisted temptation to the extent that a young inexperienced knave can do in a situation like that. Mm-hmm. And then his horse comes back to he gets his horse back. I think, I don't remember the exact point, but without like mapping it exactly, I was reading it as each of the items came back to him through some magic in response to him living up to a knightly ideal.
As I recall, the horse, he finds the horse outside the Green Knight's chapel under circumstances, which we should transit into spoiler talk if we're going to talk about the end of the movie, because that's, I don't know how everybody took that, but I think that's just a big and interesting thing to talk about in general.
Which part, the very end or the last temptation of Gawain?
Well, let's transit into spoiler territory if you have not seen the movie and you want to see the movie before getting into the ending. Warning that we're about to get into the ending.
We're going to get into it, all right.
But it is exactly the last temptation. He goes to the Green Knight. He sees a version of a possibility play out where he runs away from the Green Knight, goes back home, lives a fulfilling life, succeeds King Arthur when King Arthur dies, becomes the king, has a child and an heir, and lives a hollow and meaningless and empty life that doesn't fulfill him.
And can't keep the kingdom together either, yeah. I think, point.
Yeah, everything falls apart, and it probably because he is the land and the land is him, and, you know, he's hollow. And then eventually he takes off his mother's protective girdle and his head falls off because the Green Knight got him after all. And then he wakes up out of that fantasy, dream, prophecy, foretelling, whatever it is, and maybe just a fear of what might happen. And he takes the girdle off and drops his protection and opens himself up to whatever the Green Knight's going to do to him. And the Green Knight says, okay, here we go. And then the movie ends, which...
off with your head, yeah.
Says off with your head, yeah.
Genevieve referenced the poem earlier and how the ending of it might affect what we were expecting. Keith, as our 25 years passed, but still more than any of us medieval scholar, you want to cover what we were expecting?
Yeah, it's been a while since I've read this. I can't remember if I actually read it in the Middle English or translation, because unlike Chaucer, which you can teach yourself how to read Chaucer in half an hour or whatever, but this is a northern dialect. It's quite different. And I tried to reread part of it before seeing this film. It's like, oh, it's been too long, or I need to read a translation of this. But as I recall, the poem is, and now we're going to get into spoiler territory here. So if you haven't read Gawain the Green Knight,
what's the Statue of Limitations?
How many centuries?
Yeah.
With the revelation that the Joel Edgerton character essentially is also the Green Knight. And this has all been in great fun. And he just gives Gawain a little nick, and that's it. And on his way, Happy New Year. End of poem. I read that as what happens here. I know it's going to be, and Lowry said you can read it a couple of different ways and they're both interesting, and that's fine too. But I see this as a happy ending. I think Gawain has finally become a person of substance. You know, he's lived up to the covenant he agreed to fulfill by returning, you know, letting the Green Knight return the blow. He gets a nice little smile on his face. He says, now off with your head. But I think it's a joke. You know, I think I'm just being optimistic, but I think he goes back to, I guess they don't call it Camelot, but to essentially Camelot, and is a better person and a more put together knight, and can actually lead a meaningful life that is a mere reflection of the hollow life that he saw himself living. Now, you can read it another way if you want to as well. I'd love to know where everyone else falls on this ending.
I almost think you have to read it the way you just said. I mean, if you read it is the other way, I mean, it's just, what is the point of any of what he's just done?
Right.
So, right. Like, you know, he's, you know, he just for him to be dealt the same blow is not a satisfying ending at all. And it makes it, and it ends up diminishing all of the substantive, you know, gains that he made for himself as a human being. I'd like to think that your reading is the correct one. I think maybe you can hear something in the tone there, or at the end, right? I mean, just something the way that line is delivered, there's a lightness to it.
That's how I read it. Yeah.
Well, there's also the refrain throughout the film of it's only a game. You know, Arthur says it to him, and his mother says it to him. And there's also, I think maybe we will get into this more in the second half when we talk about connections and characters. But there's also, I think, a very strong implication that this is being orchestrated to some extent by his mother, who is unnamed, but I think the film strongly implies is Morgan Le Fay, who, if I'm correct, Keith, in the poem is the one who sort of like is involved in the Green Knight's like activation.
So, all right, I get into actually territory here, but okay. Actually, Gawain's mother in most accounts is Morgause.
Right. No, I know right. that, but I think and there's a conflation happening here.
The conflation, definitely in Excalibur. I think this film may be making the same conflation. And the poem, Gawain the Green Knight, the mysterious blindfolded or forget exactly how she's covered up woman that we see in this is Morgana, and you know, and we're maybe left to think that in this, of this version as well,
right? And I so kind of how what I read, because we see his mother at the beginning sort of casting this not attending court, presumably because Merlin is there and they don't get along, and staying behind to sort of, you know, do this invocation, this spell of sorts, you know, and then the Green Knight appears, and you know, her reassuring him that it's a game, and I believe it's her voice that we hear the fox speaking in. And if we are to also suspect that she is the blindfolded woman, I interpret it to mean that his mom is kind of like guiding him or you know, accompanying him through this journey to kind of help him establish his legend. That was my reading of the character and their relationship anyway. It's certainly not like explicit in the film, but because of that, I think in the it's just a game refrain, I think I also like come down on the quote unquote happy ending side. But to go back to sort of Lowry's fixation with legend and the stories we tell, I think there's also kind of a compelling argument to be made for the other way as sort of a more knotty question to leave viewers with.
I certainly read it as a happy ending, but I think if, without knowing the old story, without knowing the poem, I don't think that I would have the impetus to read it that way. I don't think that I would have the context to read it that way. And I might read the Green Knight's playfulness at the end, like leaning in and saying that to him as a kind of boo, you know, as an end of the story that's like, here's the monster at the end of this book. Surprise, surprise. As like a playfulness that's not murderous. When I interviewed Innocent, we talked a bunch about the ending specifically and how he was told to play it. And he talked a lot about how the Green Knight is, as he put it, a wind-up artist. You know, he's a mischievous figure who has been like embodied in order to test men. But he really enjoys that. It, like he's playful and he's funny. Innocent described him as like a good person to have a pint with. So I can see where just the way he plays it would imply to me that there's something non-murderous going on. But I think if I didn't have the poem, if I didn't have any other evidence, I would probably read that ending as he sends him back and what happens, what we've seen play out happens. You know, he lives his life and then his head falls off. Like, I'm not sure that the movie necessarily backs that interpretation in any way, but it's kind of what I would have gotten was that he's basically saying, like, you came here being a coward the entire way. Like, it's good that you came here, but you know, in the end, you've kind of bartered away your soul with your choices, particularly with your choices of spurning Essen, your lover, and like ending up with all of these hollow experiences as a result. So I don't know. I don't know that I would read it as positively if I didn't have the extra texturals to mess with.
You know what that scene of him kneeling in front of the Green Knight reminded me of? Arthur and Excalibur kneeling in front of Uria, whatever Urines. To ask him to be knighted or to knight him.
Is that your That's way fair. To segue into connections?
Maybe. I don't know. What do you think, Tasha? Is that a good segue?
I think we should segue into connections, but I'm going to bring up a connection that isn't to Excalibur, just as a sort of illustration. There's that moment when he meets Winifred, when he asks, she asks him to help her, and he basically says, okay, what am I going to get out of it? And I kind of lit up because it feels to me like that's a very conscious callback to Eric Rohmer's Percival, where you have a knight that goes out on a quest and he's basically told, like, everywhere you go, find out what you can get. Like, if you meet a lady, ask her for her ring. If you meet a lady, like, ask her for her maidenhead. Like, basically, you should be getting something out of every meeting that you're in, out of everything that you do. And just for that moment, I was like, how many other references are in this thing that I'm just not versed enough in the literature of the time, in the every other movie that's ever been made to get? Because I have a feeling that this piece is pretty rich in references, in shadows and shades of other movies, of other stories. And like, I'd love to see David Lowery's annotated version of it.
I think he would probably be happy to do that for Criterion or something eventually.
All right. Well, get on it, Criterion, because that may be the only way we get it. In the meantime, I guess we can start talking about the specific connections it has with one specific movie that we talked about last week. So we'll be right back after this break to talk about the connections between The Green Knight and Excalibur.
Oh, greatest of kings, indulge me in this friendly Christmas game. Let whichever of your knights is boldest of blood and wildest of hearts step forth. Take up arms, and try with honor to land a blow against me. Whomsoever nicks me shall lay claim to this my arm. Its glory and riches shall be thine. But thy champ must bind himself to this. Should he land a blow, then one year and yuletide hence, he must seek me out yonder to the Green Chapel. Six nights to the north. He shall find me there and bend a knee and let me strike him in return. Be it a scratch on the check or a cut in the throat, I will return what was given to me, and then in trust and friendship we shall part. Who then? Who is willing to engage with me?
Now it's time for Connections, when we bring these two films together and talk about all the things they have in common. What do these movies have in common, y'all?
So there's this guy called Arthur. See?
Well, we don't know that there's this guy called Arthur, per se.
There's this idea called Arthur.
There you go. I think it's interesting, given what we talked about a lot in Excalibur, in terms of like the episodic stories and skipping past decades and decades on end, that we arrive in The Green Knight at, as I say, a Camelot that's very clearly near its end, where everybody is old and tired. I don't think there's any way to link the two of these movies together as, you know, like one, like people keep trying to do with all Pixar movies. The versions of Gawain are just too different and the timelines are too different, because this is an old and aging court where the knights are still around. They're just very old and tired. But it seems to me that The Green Knight does just like drill down into one very specific period that's covered in Excalibur, where Excalibur is trying to tell all of the stories. This is trying to tell a story about a very specific moment of Camelot's history.
Yeah, and it's doing so in a much less expository way, right down to not really naming any of the characters other than Gawain / Gawain / Gwen, all the ways they pronounce it.
Garin. I would swear that the king says Garin.
Oh, see, this is why we need subtitles. I actually am, when this movie is available with the subtitles, I would absolutely like to rewatch with that, because I feel like there's just so much in the dialogue I miss. Or maybe not. Maybe this is a felt rather than deciphered movie, but
I don't know that understanding the dialogue is deciphering a movie. I don't know that that's going too far. But like the opening where we're getting the narration about how like this is not that king, the king that took the sword from the stone, I only got maybe half of that. I found the fox pretty hard to understand. Like, mm-hmm. I think that even, like, regardless of, like, quality of audio system or whatever, I think there are different parts of the movie that are deliberately pitched at the edges of experience, and that subtitles are going to help us all with those.
Yeah.
I mean, you do have a pretty substantial monologue by Alicia Vikander in the film, but it is, you know, I mean, I think maybe it's a Christopher Nolan thing where it's like, where, you know, maybe Lowry doesn't necessarily care that much for us to hear the dialogue. Maybe the dialogue isn't really the point for him, but I guess I wasn't quite as at sea as I expected to be. I mean, I sat front row in the music boxes, which I generally do. Because there's a distance from the front row to the stage, and so it's good for leg room, and I can still see the screen quite well. And I didn't have quite as many problems as I thought I would based on what I'd heard about the sound being a little bit garbled.
Yeah. I sat where I chose to sit, and then I had to move because somebody without a mask sat next to me. But, one thing they have in common is, you know, we talked about The Green Knight being the story of Gawain's becoming of living up to the ideals, proving himself, becoming a knight in truth and not just in name. I mean, that stuff is all over Excalibur as well, this idea of living up to this chivalric ideal. But, you know, I think it plays off in a multitude of ways there. I mean, it refers to the opening credits of The Green Knight refers to the source poem as a chivalric romance, which is, you know, I think that's a fair idea of how Lowry wants you to look at this film, which would be as a story of chivalry and living up to ideals. And, you know, to what degree is that also true of Excalibur? I mean, to what degree is this also a story of various, I want to say men and women, but it really is just men in Excalibur, of living up to the roles that they are supposed to be playing?
I think that in the sense of, you know, what people are meant to be doing, maybe the closest parallel between Gawain and the Green Knight and Excalibur is the character of Percival that we see in Excalibur, the version
exactly
of him.
What I was gonna say.
He's young and callow, and we see that he comes from ignoble beginnings and kind of cowardly beginnings, but he has this ambition to become a knight. And the way in which Gawain stands up to take on the Green Knight in Green Knight just really reminds me of the way that Percival stands up to challenge Gawain in Excalibur for the Queen's honor when nobody else will. There's that same sort of strange, I guess we're meant to assume in Excalibur that when Gawain suggests that the Queen has been carrying on with Lancelot and nobody else will defend her, like no other knight will rise to the Queen's defense, we're meant to believe that every single one of them believes that, yeah, she's definitely having an affair with him. But Percival stands up exactly as King Arthur did earlier before he was a king or a knight. No armor, no weapons of his own, no helm, no shield of his own. But he goes up against a knight that's, you know, bigger and stronger and far more well equipped because honor is on the line, because chivalry is on the line, because he feels it's what he's meant to do. And as a result, the king knights him. I feel like that's a conscious parallel that Lowry makes, because in the same way that King Arthur pulls Percival up and knights him so he can take place in this fight, the king in The Green Knight hands Excalibur to Gawain so he'll have a sword of his own to fight with. And in both cases, it's kind of like handing the signal honor to this callow boy who's the only one stepping up to do what needs to be done. And it feels like a coming of age, like a rite of passage for both of them. But in the end, it's rewarding, you know, the only person who's maintaining their honor, the only person who's stepping up, even if it's a very foolish thing for both of them to do. And in the end, the fact that Percival is the one to like purge himself of any taint and drive himself to the end of the earth to find the grail is because he's the purest. It's because he's the one who has best served the king. And I think that his kind of ability to go through all of these horrible magical experiences and like a horrible form of torture and still come out on the other side is pretty much exactly Gawain's journey.
Yeah, you basically said much more articulately what I was going to say. That was the connection I really thought about on this theme of honor, chivalry, and proving yourself was the connection between Percival and the Gawain of the Green Knight. I will say though, I think that Percival's a little further along on that journey. You know, I think the qualities that he shows in stepping up are qualities that he had displayed before of courage and of virtue and of, you know, of feeling like he wants to prove something and wants to do something for Arthur. It's not this kind of rash, impulsive, ill thought through thing. And he's, you know, for him to put himself in real danger, he is a humble person in a way that Gawain is not.
In The Green Knight, the whole Winifred sequence feels like the most kind of explicit exploration of that, I guess. You know, the other sort of moments we see of Gawain's chivalry are perhaps a little more debatable. But I think going to retrieve the head of a woman who clearly has her head on at her behest, just because, you know, she asks you to, is certainly a peak honor, honorable behavior, you know, and he does it, and it happens in a very, there's like the underwater light show, right? Am I remembering that correctly?
Yeah. So it goes to red when he's diving down deep, which mm-hmm. seems to be the color of magic in this world, because yeah. when the Green Knight shows up in the court, King Arthur looks to Merlin, and Merlin kind of closes his eyes and everything goes red. And then he looks back at the king and just shakes his head like, you know, you do not want to mess with this. Mm-hmm. And I think we're meant to understand that some sort of like magic is taking place, that he's swimming into some sort of magical realm when he dives down, you know, far more deeply than could be possible in what looks mm-hmm. like a very small bog, and finds her head down at the bottom of it.
Yeah. But yeah, that, like I said, strikes me as the most explicit moment of chivalry, honor, whatever you want to call it, for Gawain in The Green Knight, which I think is maybe much less forthright in its expressions of chivalry as they apply to its main character.
I mean, there's also the resistance as far as it goes of the lady mm-hmm. in the castle, and the fact that he is, you know, filling this promise to go have his head cut off.
Sure. Yeah, that's the big one, I guess.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So it's, you know, it's not always pretty, but it is a kind of chivalry he's attempting.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting that he performs this chivalric act of retrieving the woman's head after another lord, you know, another supposed person of power and honor who should be abiding by the chivalric code, violated her and cut her head off for denying him, which feels like it parallels what happens with Uther and Egrain in, you know, he doesn't cut her head off, but he sees something he wants and he doesn't care what she wants and he takes it. And in the same sort of way, she's the woman, Winifred, has this story of somebody saw what he wanted and he took it from me and he left me like not only dead, but, you know, decapitated, sullied. I think this is a movie very interested in like what it means to be dishonored in various ways, not just by making the wrong choices, but like actually like leaving marks on yourself, leaving stains on your soul via either things you do or things other people do to you.
It also highlights another connection between these films. I mean, and most films for that matter, but I think this is maybe a good time to talk about the roles of women and sex in these two films. Kind of a part of the chivalric code, you know, has to do with women and acting on their behalf and protecting them and whatnot, you know, but there's also a lot in both of these films, but much more in Excalibur, I think, where women are either obstacles or, you know, objects. And I don't think that Excalibur is necessarily in agreement with that view. I think it's more kind of expressing the ideas of the era or the culture being depicted here. Green Knight, again, and clearly I just want to talk about his mom slash Morgana, but I think like there's maybe a much more active role for the women characters here, while they're at the same time, they are to a certain extent used as, I don't want to say sex objects, but definitely like characters who have sort of sex and sexuality like hardwired into them, into how Gawain interacts with them. But, you know, in general, I think the female characters we get in Green Knight are more complex. and like a lot of the movie is more complex. But we do get Helen Mirren's Morgan Le Fay in Excalibur. So it's kind of a trade-off.
I think there's some real direct parallels between the versions of Morgana, Morgan Le Fay, whatever you want to call her, in both of these versions, in that they both have sons that they ritualistically take care of with their magic in order to promote them in the world. Yet both of them seem to want those sons to go out and pursue specific agendas that their mothers have defined, and that their mothers to some degree can't undertake themselves because they're women and older women in a society that doesn't have a whole lot of use for that. I think it's interesting that Morgana in Excalibur seems to be like, you know, as I say, an Eve in the garden, like just a bringer of evil into an innocent and pure place. And it's because she lusts after power, but it's also to a degree because she wants revenge, for her mother's rape, revenge for her murdered father, to some degree, even revenge for Arthur being stolen as a baby, although the fact that the revenge is on him makes that a little complicated. But she is just kind of the heart of the movie's ideals of pursuing your desires will destroy everyone and everything. You know, she pursues her unnatural lust with her brother. She pursues her hatred and her desire for revenge. She pursues her hunger for power. And like all these things bring down Camelot. Whereas the version of Morgana, whatever you want to call her, in Green Knight, seems only to want to push her son to be a better person. But once again, you know, does it with magic and ritual and kind of with offering him a cheat code. Yeah. You know, it definitely, I'm not sure that the movie gives us any reason to feel one way or another, whether she means for him to actually wear that girdle and be protected from the Green Knight, or if she expects him to learn that he needs to cast it away and face the Green Knight without fear. Is she giving him a way to cheat death, or is she inviting him to rise above like needing that kind of crutch? I don't know.
I think she's giving him magic to enter a magical situation. You know, the Camelot and the Round Table that we get in Green Knight is just so industrial and bland and flat and just lacking any fecundity, to use your word from earlier, Tasha, you know, and as I said before, like, we don't see her in that space. She declines to join him there and is kind of off doing her own magic thing, you know, and she's clearly a character who is associated with this greenness, this natural, you know, world, this magic, the same way that Merlin is in Excalibur, you know, and I guess Morgana to an extent, though, I think it's, we're meant to see it as being sort of twisted through her. But the mother character is just so clearly a magical figure in a story that has these very clear moments of magic happen in a way that throw the protagonist. You know, they're not what he is expecting, but because he has this sort of magical talisman, maybe like kind of puts him on the playing field that he needs to be on for this scenario that she has, again, in my opinion, kind of devised for him.
I think it's interesting that the Green Knight leans really heavily into kind of the occult version of like women as the source of mysteries, literally, you know, mysteries in the older sense of magic and myth and things not understood. I mean, pretty much all of the women in the Green Knight are the sources of mysteries, except Essen, the prostitute, who puts her heart out on the line and gets it rejected. Mm-hmm. Like, she's kind of an open book. But, you know, Winifred is a spiritual figure. She's a sort of a ghost and a challenge. And
I think she's a saint, right?
She, mm-hmm. Yeah. Well,
I mean, Saint not Winifred, here, but yeah.
Saint Winifred is a thing, but I don't know if this character is that character.
I think she's like a famously beheaded saint. So
yeah. And this is the rejecting someone's advances and being killed for it. It's like there's a lot of saint stories that feature that detail.
So there's that whole paganism, Christianity mingling thing happening again there.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's fairly overt in the movie. But, you know, Morgan, the source of magic, the lady, the source of a lot of confusion about exactly what she wants and what she's willing to do with it. And then there's the blindfolded woman that accompanies her everywhere, seemingly as a chaperone, who kind of echoes Morgan and her occultists, who also go blindfolded in the same way. Like, all of these things are mysteries. The women in Excalibur kind of feel like open books. Like, Morgana just wants power and like wants revenge and wants her son to be a great king. And everybody else just kind of pretty much wants to survive and maybe not get hurt. There's just
Guinevere
not a whole
just
lot
wants
of depth.
To be loved
and have wonderful hair. But yeah. I would.
She does have
I would
good hair.
I would throw this out as they kind of mirror Gawain's complete lack of understanding of women in a way. I mean, they're a mystery to him. I mean, Essen is not. I mean, and this person with whom he seems to have a real connection, even if I feel like he's rejecting her because he knows he has to out of his, because of his position and her position. And like beyond that, every woman around him is a mystery to him, including his mother, who has this whole life with her fellow coven or whatever we want to call them that he's either not aware of, or if he is aware of it, I don't think he understands.
Yeah.
So speaking of Morgan and her coven and just sort of the use of magic in this movie, I think the degree to which both of these movies kind of draw on paganism for the idea of its magic, even though paganism is kind of leaving the world and being replaced by Christianity in both cases, I think that's interesting. And I think the way both of these movies like focus on nature as a source of magic, whether it's the dragon, the sleeping dragon basically being Britain and the land in Excalibur, you know, it conjures up its breath in the form of mist when Merlin calls on it. It dies when the king is sick. It comes back when he's alive. Like there's just a mystical significance to the power of the land in Excalibur that's laid out very explicitly and stated over and over. Whereas, as was pointed out earlier in The Green Knight, like the closer Gawain gets to the chapel, the closer he gets to the heart of it all, the less desiccated and dead and bare everything gets, and the more wild and lush and, well, I'll say it again, fecund everything gets. There's just this sense of Gawain definitely is like moving from the new world, the Christian world of like tiredness and literality, back to the old pagan world where the old gods are slowly walking off into the mist, but everything's still wild and uncontrolled and green. There's that moment where he stands at the edge of the Green Chapel and is just looking through this tunnel of leaves and trees. That's one of my favorite shots in the film. It's just gorgeous. But it definitely evokes the idea of like somebody even further leaving recognized known human lands and heading into a place of magic.
Right. And of course, the you know, towards the beginning of his journey, that, you know, when he encounters the, I guess, what, child bandits, that's just kind of a wasteland that he's kind of, or I guess a battlefield that he's
a battlefield walking. Where no one's been buried and it's unclear who's been fighting who or why. Yeah, it's a really remarkable image.
Yeah. And I mean, and I love that actor so much. He's so unusual. Keoghan, I don't know. I wish I
can't. No, he's good.
He's so good and so unnerving in every performance he seems to give. But it's interesting to think about that progression in the way that the film looks. You don't have that kind of transformation in Excalibur. I think it pretty much the world of Excalibur kind of looks like it does from start to finish.
No, I think that's exactly wrong, because it blooms
the way you end.
Yeah. Well, it blooms during the Golden Age and then sort of falls into it.
I see. Forget everything I just said.
Yes, everything. I'm gonna pretend that didn't happen.
Okay.
That child bandits scene, I love that we're calling them child bandits, but it also kind of segues into, and I think another one of the scenes in The Green Knight that people are talking about a lot, which is the sort of 362 skeleton corpse and back again, a very David Lowery shot, certainly evoked a ghost story for me and others from what I understand. But I think like if we're thinking about it in terms of a connection about magic and paganism and Christianity for that matter, like there's some really interesting reading I think you can do into that moment in terms of like resurrection, Christ figure. We talked about the Last Temptation of Christ parallels in the ending, you know, there. I think that that moment with the skeleton maybe kind of sets up the ending to a certain extent, but it's in the middle of a forest, you know, and there's death and life everywhere, and there's resurrection, and you know, with this idea of, you know, the old ways or the old magic leaving the land as Christianity moves in. Like, Christianity didn't get rid of paganism. It just kind of like absorbed certain ideas for its own purposes. You know, that's how they get you. at least if you're a pagan in the 14th century or whatever, you know.
Right. And you know, something like the Green Knight is something, a piece of possibly a piece of paganism that hasn't been quite overwritten entirely. It's you know, this sort of, mm-hmm. you know, this vegetable deity or whatever that's now taking the form of a knight, although imperfect in both ways. And he lives in a chapel that's not really a chapel, and he seems to be a piece of vegetation, almost like a Swamp Thing kind of thing, or the Jolly Green Giant in some ways. I think it's a neat depiction of that character.
Not actually green though, right? More no. stone.
He's kind of blue.
Yeah.
Kind of green blue. Maybe he's bluish in that opening. Well, I mean, to some degree, he's just reflecting the stone around him. I think he looks a lot greener within the chapel, but when we first see him within the chapel, he's literally rooted into the tree. Mm-hmm. He may look more green just because he's, you know, gotten nutrition as opposed to being called up to ride across all of Christendom because some witch wants her son to be a better guy.
Delicious chlorophyll.
I hadn't thought about this until you brought it up, but there's actually a really direct parallel between the two films in terms of when we get that 360 pan and we see him dead, and then we pan back and see him possibly having just experienced that as a sort of flash forward of what's going to happen if he just lies there and waits for somebody to rescue him. He crawls across the ground and manages to start slowly rubbing the rope mm-hmm. against his sword, just as we see Percival hung up by his neck and the rope slowly rubbing against the spurs of a dead knight above him until it snaps. You know, both of them kind of suffer through this death experience and come out stronger for it on the other end. Both of them kind of have a vision of death, a vision that helps them kind of rebirth themselves.
I don't know. There's something too, like the worlds in both of these films being calculated to kind of reward ultimately the right behavior, right? I mean, like things are very engineered for these characters to come out on the other side better, and also, you know, rewarded for their actions
if they make the right choices.
Yes, yeah, of course.
Yeah, I'm ashamed to say that that we have a podcast at Polygon called Galaxy Brains, and the hosts of that talked about how this is basically a video game or a role playing game. You know, you go through the story of Green Knight, and you kind of have fetch quests and choices to make. And if you make the wrong choice, you die. And then after that, you just keep going on. It made me see that skeleton scene kind of differently. But it is true that in both of these cases, there's kind of a like make the moral choice, get the good path, make the immoral choice, get the bad path, kind of black and white morality to it all. Or green and red morality, if you listen to the lady.
I did also think about that scene just tied to the theme of legend, and almost like wondering if there's sort of a multiverse or a split timelines, you know, kind of suggestion happening there too. Because like if someone dies at the beginning of his quest, he doesn't become a legend, you know, like the legend stops there. So I think maybe that scene is a little bit, you know, kind of toying with the idea of, you know, stories only become legends if they're allowed to continue and have an ending. So I don't know. I think there's, as with so much in The Green Knight, there's you know, multiple ways to read that scene, but I choose to kind of think of it in terms of storytelling and myth making and all the things that Lowry, as a filmmaker, and this film in particular, are kind of wrapped up in.
I mean, do we think there's a parallel in that we don't actually see Arthur die? He's carried off into legend. We don't mm-hmm. actually see Gawain live or die. We just sort of end right. it there with however you want to take it.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. And to go back to the ending again, it's certainly the most straightforward interpretation is that this is just him sort of like gaming out the situation and like how bad it could go and you know, and why he needs to make the right choice. But it's also like another fork the story could take, you know, and another form the legend could take or not. The legend would never even take root because it ended in such a kind of dishonorable place. So
I like that reading of it, Genevieve. That's interesting. But I also think that if it is him gaming out what could happen, it sets him up as someone who has visions of the future. So it's kind of a little laying the groundwork for the final act.
That's true too. Yeah.
Well, it seems like there are a lot of paths that this story could take. It seems like there are a lot of choices that characters in this situation can make. And I'm sure people are going to carry on making Arthurian films where they make different choices and highlight different elements. And I guess when that happens, we'll come back to what we think of The Green Knight later when we've had more time to read even more about it and think even more about it. But for the moment, Excalibur is available for digital purchase or rental on a lot of services, like a lot of services. And there's a physical edition on Blu-ray if you swing that way. The Green Knight is in theaters right now. We'll be right back with your next picture show. Finally, it's time for your next picture show, where we catch you up on films or film-related items that you also might want to seek out. Genevieve, what in the film world is good for you?
Well, I'll talk about that in a minute. I just want to give sort of a flyby recommendation based on this pairing. We talked about if we wanted to do like a little side discussion on other Arthurian films we like, but I don't know that there are actually that many that we really want to like dig into or recommend deeply. Plus, the one that I would probably talk about, I have previously recommended for your next picture show. So I just want to give another follow-up tip of the hat to Joe Cornish's The Kid Who Would Be King. Actually, Keith, I think you might have also recommended this recently.
Yeah, no, it's a good movie.
Yeah, it came out in 2019. It definitely has sort of like 80s kids on an adventure movie vibes. You know, Joe Cornish also did Attack the Block, which I think we all love. And Kid Who Would Be King, you know, and definitely not a perfect film, but a fun film. And, you know, as another connection to this pairing, features Patrick Stewart, this time as an older Merlin, but there is also a young, hip, fun Merlin in The Kid Who Would Be King. So, yeah, if you haven't checked that out yet, I think it would be a fun one. So the film I actually want to talk about, and I guess recommend, even though it's a film that I certainly have reservations about, but I think it is a discussable film and a film that we probably need to talk about at least briefly. And that is another A24 film called Zola that came out last month. It is based originally on a tweet thread by the titular Zola, who went who kind of got wrapped up in a fabulous adventure that she tweeted about at length and was turned into a Rolling Stone article that was subsequently turned into this movie directed by Janisca Bravo, who co-wrote the screenplay with the playwright Jeremy O. Harris. And as I previously alluded to, I definitely have some issues with this movie, particularly as it applies to its characterization. But I think it is a really interesting, it's an interesting adaptation exercise, and it's an interesting tonal film. If you've read either the article or the tweet thread, there's maybe not a whole lot in the narrative that is going to be, you know, surprising. It actually feels like kind of flat as an arc, but there is a very distinct energy to both the film and the performances, particularly Riley Keough as the woman who kind of wraps Zola into this misadventure. She is giving a very committed performance. And I think it's definitely a film that anyone who wants to like talk about what film in 2021 is about needs to see. It's also probably not going to be like on my top 10 films of the year, but I definitely, it's one that I like want people to see so we can talk about it. We kind of never got around to doing a proper pairing or even a Patreon episode on it. So I'm kind of using this as an opportunity to talk about Zola.
Yeah, that film, I mean, I absolutely understand potentially people's discomfort with how it navigates race and how it navigates sex workers and how it navigates abusive relationships and a whole bunch of other things. But man, the verve with which it's made is hard to argue with. You know, the little voiceover. I hate voiceover in films. I loved the voiceover in this film.
I mean, if you can't do voiceover in a film based on a tweet thread, when can you use it?
But just, you know, it's up there for me with The Informant in terms of humorous asides that let you know exactly what's going on in a character's head during periods where you really would like to know what's going on in that character's head, where it really changes the story, how they're perceiving things and what meaning they're taking out of things. It's real lively. It's real funny. It's definitely got more like flaccid aging penises than you've seen in probably most movies ever.
So I haven't seen this movie yet, but now I'm curious.
Do you want to cut this podcast short so you can get out there for the last show? They're not attractive, y'all. They're not beautiful stunt cocks. This is not your beautiful Boogie Nights. I think that the movie definitely makes some interesting statements about how unattractive sex is if you're not the one having it.
When it's work,
when you're not into it, when you're not engaged in it in some way, when it's not something that you personally signed on for. But it's funny about it. You know, it's, I think American movies that take sex as kind of humorous and not all important are pretty rare. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the weird and fun aspects of this movie is just like the way it treats sex, which it spends a lot of time treating with sex and the commoditization of it in ways that I think are pretty unique and a lot of fun.
Did you have the sensation that I had, though, at the end of the film, which is like, you know, what did we, it reminded me of the end of but after reading when he says, what have we learned, Palmer?
Yeah.
Just like, I guess we learned never to do it again. It had that kind of quality to it. Just I got to the end of the movie and I thought like, okay, I guess I just saw that and that, I guess we learned never to do it again. It was like that kind of an ending for me that, so I left the theater feeling a little bit vaguely unsatisfied as much as I enjoyed the ride. I mean, it is quite a ride for sure.
I mean, I was planning to like pack up and go off on a stripping trip with somebody that I'd met in a restaurant like 10 minutes earlier. And yeah, it kind of made me rethink that plan. But yeah, I mean, it's based on something that really happened to somebody. Real life does not always come with metaphors or messages or conclusions.
Yeah, it's a kind of a slight film overall, you know, and it's short. It's 90 minutes and there are several scenes that are arguably drawn out longer than they, again, arguably need to be. But also like they're kind of cool. Like there's some like really neat driving scenes. This is in a lot of ways a road movie. Mm-hmm. And it, you know, it has some kind of interesting moments with the aesthetics of that. But yeah, it does. It's like a story you'd hear at a party, you know, like, wow, that happened. That's wild. All right, moving on, you know, and there's definitely a little of that with this movie, too. But when you're in it, when you're experiencing it, you're definitely along for the ride.
It reminded me a fair bit of American Honey in that way.
Absolutely. I got American Honey vibes.
Both because it's like a crazy young people road trip. And just because of that sense of like, oh, this is a window into a world that I would never enter, that I don't have the stuff that it takes to enter this world. What an interesting opportunity to look into how other people live their lives, like in a way adjacent to mine, and yet which I've never encountered.
Also, of course, Riley Keough in both is kind of a mischief maker.
Sure. Yeah.
Entirely fair.
Well, thank you for convening this panel on Zola. I feel better. Scott, what about you? What's been good for you lately?
It hasn't been all that recent, but a film that I saw at True False in 2020 has 2020, is that right? Oh my gosh, has finally opened in New York, and it's a film that stuck with me for a long time, and I'm glad people have a chance to see it now. It's called The Viewing Booth. It's a film by this filmmaker named Renan Alexandrowicz, and it's a pretty basic like experiment, really, where he has this ends up settling on this one student, something like almost like an academic experiment where he has this young woman who is this Jewish American. He puts her in this booth and then asks her questions about these various short like web videos that he's showing her, and they're all videos that have to deal with the Palestinians and with the realities of the occupation. And and she comes into the situation with certain biases, and it's fascinating to see how these images, which are these successions of images and clips that are designed really to persuade someone of something, how she talks her way through it in a way that affirm her biases going in. And it's just a fascinating and very frustrating example of how hard it is to shake people from the a certain the point of view that they're bringing. You lock into a certain opinion on something, and it's very hard to shake anyone from it, even when you're designing footage to do that very thing, and maybe feel extremely pessimistic about the world that we live in. But it is a film that I cannot stop thinking about, and it is constantly relevant when you're in our age of misinformation and people kind of not only affirming biases but affirming things that are patently and often ludicrously false. It's an and this is not a dummy who's the subject here is a smart young woman who has an interesting point of view on these things. It's just but cannot be wrested away from the attitudes, I guess, that she brings to this experiment. So I don't know, it's worth seeing. It's called The Viewing Booth. It won't take up a huge amount of your time, but it's something you will not forget if you see it. It's in New York now, and hopefully it will trickle its way out to other places and certainly on streaming services as well. The Viewing Booth. What about you, Tasha?
Well, I'm going to possibly preview a future Next Picture Show to come. At least I hope so, because we ran into an interesting timing issue with this one. There was a movie that I saw at Sundance in 2019 called 9 Days, the debut film of Edson Oda, that blew my socks off. I absolutely loved this movie. And it was picked up and it was going to hit theaters in 2020. And then it got put off because of the pandemic. And it's in theaters right now. As we're recording this, it's the week after release. I hope it's still playing in theaters. It had a very limited release, and it seems like the kind of small indie that's likely to only play a few major cities and then quietly disappear until it turns up on digital. And because of that, we kind of discussed doing it for the show. The problem was the perfect movie to match it with is Corrieta's Afterlife. 9 Days is a movie about the bureaucracy that decides who gets to be born. Winston Duke from Black Panther just has this giant meal of a role as a bureaucrat living alone in a tiny house in the middle of nowhere in some preliminary space, interviewing souls that want to be born and deciding for himself whether they're worthy. He has literally slots to fill, like an employer. When somebody dies on Earth, he gets to send somebody new down. And these people come to him fully formed, and he interrogates them at length about what they'll do if they become people. And it's the perfect match for Afterlife, which similarly looks at the broken down, fading bureaucracy that determines what people's most important memories were and then passes them on to the next stage. The problem is that Afterlife has been just utterly unavailable for a very long time. It's not streaming anywhere. It's not available in physical media. So Afterlife is coming to Blu-ray in a Criterion edition in mid-August. Which is great. And it's going to be on the Criterion channel as of October. We're going to put off this particular pairing until it's easy for people to see both of these movies. And by easy, I mean, sign up for Criterion or buy a disc, but at least they'll both be available streaming at some point. But if you get a chance to see 9 Days in theaters, if it's playing where you live, and if you feel safe going to theaters, this movie is, it's divisive in a way. It may be too quirky for Scott, frankly. It's the kind of movie, like people we know, critics that we know and respect walked out of it because they just weren't in the mood for something this whimsical, I suppose, and mordant and weird. But it is exactly and specifically my jam. It's such a unique vision. The performances are just unbelievable. Zazie Beetz co-stars, Tony Hale from Arrested Development. Gosh, off the top of my head, Benedict Wong from Doctor Strange, Bill Skarsgård from It. Like almost everybody in this movie is somebody that you recognize playing a role that maybe you haven't seen them play. And to me, it's one of those movies that maybe sets out to have a message that's a little too strong for some people. And I resisted it for a long time. And then it just more and more and more got me caught up in it. I think people who loved Afterlife, who love Double Life of Veronique, who just kind of love that sort of not quite magical realism, but like magically realistic frankness that just takes the assumption of magic in the everyday as read and just rolls with it. I think they'll have a really good time with this film. I think it's like very few films out there, and I deeply dug it. I really hope that we manage to get it in as a pairing months down the line when everybody can see it. That's pretty much it. But yeah, if it's in theaters, 9 days, highly recommended. Keith, what about you?
By the time this episode comes out, the 2020 Tokyo Olympics will be a distant memory, in addition to being happening in the wrong year. I was inspired by that. I watched the 1965 film Tokyo Olympiad, which is the film of the 1964 Olympics, directed by the great Japanese director Kane Chikawa. And it is it's a fantastic way to spend over 2 hours watching old Olympic events. It is a really wonderfully artful and inventive film that tries to, you know, find new ways to shoot sporting events, and there's techniques in here that I've seen borrowed by other, you know, a lot of other subsequent films, and it really does make a turn it into quite a moving spectacle. It's a wonderful time capsule of this moment in the history of Japan when it was, you know, the Olympics were hugely important for Japan as to kind of reemerging as part of the larger global community in you know 20 years after or so after the end of World War II. And it, you know, it was important for the country to put a, you know, very, you know, a peaceful and advanced and sophisticated image of itself out in the world, and this Olympics was key to that. And this film captures that, and also a lot of the individual drama of a few particular Olympians, and just the wondrousness of the events itself. It's a great movie. It's on Blu-ray, but it's also on the Criterion Channel, and that is the you want to seek out. There are different cuts of this film. Apparently, the Japanese government was not really happy with the original cut and had it cut down to 93 minutes, which is still out there. There's a 120 minute version that's, I think, on the official Olympics YouTube channel, but official or not, you go for the longer cut. It's definitely worth it.
That's a good one. I think was Criterion Channel also just featuring a whole bunch of other.
Yeah, well, they put out a box set of discs, but most of them are on the channel itself, and there's a lot of great stuff. But this is the one I want to dig into this one because I'd never seen it, and you know the Tokyo connection, and also I like Ichikawa's films, but this, I'm sure there's other things we're seeking out as well.
Well, as always, we thank everybody for their recommendations. We hope that this helps our listeners find their next picture show. And that's it for this edition of the Next Picture Show. Our next pairing will drop on August 24th and 31st. Keith, what do we have on tap?
For our next pairing, we're taking on a sometimes tuneful, sometimes troubling, always daring double feature of experimental musicals. First up, we'll be discussing Francis Ford Coppola's 1982 film, One from the Heart, starring Terry Garr as a travel agent who dreams of escaping to Bora Bora, Frederick Forrest as a mechanic who's happy to stay at home, and Raul Julia and Natasha Kinski as temptations that threaten to lure them away from one another. To make the film, Coppola recreated Las Vegas on the sound stages of American Zoetrope Studios. Upon release, it was considered a disaster. But was it? More than a little of One from the Heart's spirit lives on in Leos Carax's latest, Annette, starring Adam Driver and Marion Cotillard as lovers who might be ill-matched, and a puppet
as their daughter, the eponymous Annette. The venerable cult band Sparks provides the story and songs, Carrick provides the stylistic bravado, and the cast supplies the intense emotions. We hope you'll join us.
In the meantime, we'd like to hear your feedback on this week's discussion of The Green Knight, Excalibur, and anything else film-related you'd like to talk about. We want to include your thoughts on future episodes of the show. You can leave a short voicemail at 773-234-9730 or email us at comments@nextpictureshow.net. Finally, before closing out this week's episode, where can we find everyone these days? Keith?
Oh, I'm a freelance writer. You can find me all over the place, primarily these days at GQ, sometimes at The Ringer, TV Guide, Vulture, where I'm recapping Ted Lasso. And, I'm all over the place. And I also need to add an addendum to my triumphant last Working You Find Me Now, where I talked about how my book, Age of Cage, about Nicolas Cage movies, will be coming out in October. Well, something happened. I got a phone call saying that it's coming out in March of next year now because of COVID-related production delays. So, COVID is probably the least horrible thing that happened with COVID, but it's still kind of a bummer. But hopefully it'll be worth the wait, and it'll be out in March. Scott, how about you?
You can find me on Twitter at Scott_Tobias, and you can find my work in the New York Times, Washington Post, Vulture, The Guardian, and other fine publications. I'm also the editor-in-chief of Oscilloscope's Musings blog. Genevieve?
I am the senior TV editor at vulture.com, and you can find me on Twitter lurking at Genevieve Kosky. Tasha?
I am the film and TV editor at polygon.com. At polygon.com, you can read that interview that I did with Ralph Ineson about playing the Green Knight. I cannot recommend it enough. He was such a blast to talk to. And if you liked The Green Knight, the movie, I think you'll really dig his story about what that costume did to him and how he had to find a character by smell rather than any other sense because of the way the costume worked. He was just a blast to talk to. He was very, very colorful. You can find me on Twitter at Tasha Robinson. You can stay updated on the Next Picture Show by visiting nextpictureshow.net and via Twitter at nextpicturepod. You can also contribute to our Patreon and get bonus content at patreon.com/nextpictureshow. If you haven't subscribed to the show on Apple Podcasts already, please consider it, and please also consider rating and reviewing us, which will help others find your favorite movie podcast. Thanks to Dan the Baked Jakes for his assistance in producing this podcast. The Next Picture Show is proud to be part of the Film Spotting family of podcasts. Please tune in next time.